Tonight, more than 3 million in Puerto Rico are in the dark, potentially without power for 4 to 6 months.
We are outside of San Juan in the town of Guaynabo. It was hit very hard. A lot of destruction to homes, down trees and power lines as well. And now they're dealing with this, flooding in every direction.
The emergency management director saying the entire island is destroyed. Many of these homes not built to withstand any hurricane, let alone a Category 4.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and that Category 4 storm was Hurricane Maria, September 20th, 2017, the first Category 4 hurricane to hit Puerto Rico in almost a century. Vieques, a small island off Puerto Rico's east coast, was leveled.
All of Vieques was devastated by Maria. It was just devastating.
Linda Backel is an attorney who lives in San Juan and represents a family that lives in Vieques. Hurricane Maria destroyed the Vieques Hospital, the tiny island's only hospital. Medical workers set up an emergency refuge center with tents and trailers. But to get comprehensive hospital care, people had to go to the main island via ferry or plane, a trip that could take up to 2 hours. And it's been like that for years. Well, on January 11th, 2020, 13-year-old Jadalise Moreno Ventura wasn't feeling very well. Linda Backel is both friends with the Ventura family and their attorney. And she says Jadalise was sick enough that the family decided to make the long trip from Vieques to the hospital in San Juan.
She had a sort of fluish sort of condition, she and her brother, and they were checked out by a pediatric hospital in San Juan, where her older sister was attending some courses. And, you know, they didn't find anything serious and said, you know, check in on Monday. That was Saturday.
So the family took the ferry back to Vieques.
She was dancing and playing. On Saturday night, she went to bed. Her mother went to check on her at about 4 o'clock in the morning, and she seemed okay. And at around 6, she went into her mother's room and said she had a terrible, terrible headache. And her mother gave her some Advil, and she started to convulse.
Jadalise's mother, Jessica, rushed her daughter to the car and drove to the closest medical care on Vieques, which, 3 years after Hurricane Maria, was still that temporary tent-based emergency refuge center.
It had no mechanical breathing equipment. It didn't have the proper equipment to intubate pediatric clients. It didn't have pediatric Foleys. I mean, just really basic stuff. And transportation to the nearest real hospital was at least an hour and a half to 2 hours away by the transportation arrangements they had. If there had been a helicopter in Vieques to transport her promptly to a decent hospital, she could have received at least standard care for the condition she was in.
But no helicopter was available. So the family tried to take Jadalise to San Juan by plane.
They got her onto a plane. She went into cardiac and respiratory arrest. They took her out, and she died. It's a large family. It's a prominent family, well-known in Vieques, family of fishermen. It devastated the community, the entire community of Vieques, an island municipality with 9,000 residents. And everybody saw their child in that casket.
Jadalise Moreno Ventura died on January 12th, 2020. She was 13 years old. The official cause of death was a brain aneurysm, but doctors are still not sure what triggered it.
For at least a year, they went to her grave every day. Her sisters, her brother, her grandparents, cousins, they just went there every day.
Jadalise's family believes she would not have died if a hospital had been rebuilt on Vieques. Recall, she died almost 2.5 years after Hurricane Maria hit Vieques and Puerto Rico. So her family are suing the Puerto Rican government. Linda Backel, whom you're hearing from now, is representing them. And she says the family does not want money. What they want is access to comprehensive emergency care.
The family wants a hospital for Vieques. The family wants no more children to die from lack of medical care in Vieques. That's what they want.
The Puerto Rican government is currently fighting the lawsuit. And in the meantime, there is still no new hospital on Vieques. And on September 17th of this year, just last month, and almost exactly 5 years to the day, another hurricane hit Puerto Rico. Hurricane Fiona had less powerful winds than Maria, but just as much rain, nearly 3 feet of rain in some places, flooding homes and destroying many of the island's roads and bridges, leaving hundreds of thousands of people without power and water again. Puerto Rico's infrastructure, like the hospital on Vieques, was never fully rebuilt after Hurricane Maria, though more than $20 billion was committed to Puerto Rico's recovery. Only a fraction of that has been spent on actual recovery projects. So today, we're going to talk about why. And joining us is Adi Martinez Roman. She's the Director of Operations at the University of Puerto Rico's Resiliency Law Center that focuses on community-led disaster recovery and rebuilding processes and projects. She joins us from San Juan. Adi, welcome to the show.
Hello, Magna, to you and to all your radio listeners.
So first of all, just tell us what it's like right now. It's been, about a little bit over a month since Hurricane Fiona hit Puerto Rico. If we were to walk around San Juan or other municipalities on the island, what would we see?
Well, for us in Puerto Rico, it has been 5 years of constant disasters. It started, of course, with the hurricanes Irma and Maria in 2017, but we have had earthquakes, we had a pandemic, and then, as you mentioned, Hurricane Fiona last month. If you walk around in the metropolitan area, just looking around, it would seem fairly normal, but the wounds of the constant disasters go beyond just the superficial appearance of buildings and streets, especially because in the metropolitan area, things get fixed much faster than in other parts of Puerto Rico. So if you go within the islands, you go to the mountains, you go to the south, you still will see the amount of damage that a Category 1 hurricane like Fiona caused us, which is incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. Because a Category 1 hurricane is supposed to be fairly mild winds, but the amount of flooding, the amount of landslides and damage to houses in the south and of crops, especially crops, it has been awful.
Yeah, I mean, just that number of almost 3 feet of rain in a couple of days, in a day or so, it's hard to fathom how much water that actually means. But so the washouts, the flooding, the destruction of roads and bridges. I want to get back to what you said about the sort of the overall trauma, even if some buildings look okay. I'll get back to that in a second. But, you know, in some of those more rural areas of the island that you're talking about, Adi, I understand that, again, in the past 5 years, some people still have been living with, you know, not housing that hasn't rebuilt. What about, you know, schools, other hospitals? In general, what is the infrastructure like away from places like San Juan?
Definitely. The infrastructure is affected throughout. When I speak of infrastructure, I'm speaking about streets, but also about basic services, just as electricity and water. All that infrastructure is completely affected and hasn't been rebuilt in a way that that makes it possible to resist any event, any small event. Right now, you might hear me spotty because it's raining here, and our infrastructure is not ready yet to even withstand like basic rains. And that is very affects everything. For us, for example, the schools have been having problems since Hurricane Maria in the south with the earthquakes, and now with Hurricane Fiona, our children are basically having interruptions, constant interruptions, and not a solid infrastructure that can withstand so they can have classes. So our school systems, our children are affected in terms of health. As you know, the hospital in Vieques has not been built, but also we've had a couple of hospitals that have closed in the main island, and there is much problem for people to access specialized medical care, as a lot of our professionals are also leaving the island to get better conditions of work outside in the United States. So there is an actual crisis in healthcare in Puerto Rico right now. Yes. And so it's a accumulation of lack of planning and of lack of efficient use of the reconstruction funds that have been assigned to the island by our governments and by the federal agencies.
Right. So that is what we're going to focus on for the rest of the hour, which is why the more than $20 billion that have been committed to Puerto Rico's reconstruction have not been fully and efficiently used just yet. We have about 30 seconds before our first break, Adi. Can you just quickly tell me, again, the toll that all of this lack of school, reliable schools, water, power, streets, all the things that you said, what is the toll that it's taking on the people of Puerto Rico?
The toll is enormous in the sense that we all suffer from constant PTSD. I work closely with community leaders and with communities, and you can see in their spirit, in their mental health has been completely eroded. Also, our elders are very much the ones that suffer this constantly, because there's a lot of elders that live by themselves.
Right. Well, you know, when we come back, and I'm sorry, Adi, to interrupt there, but when we come back, we're going to try to get a deeper understanding about why this is happening. So hang on for just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about why, 5 years after Hurricane Maria, after earthquakes, after the pandemic, why a fraction of the recovery dollars, of the billions of dollars that have been committed to the reconstruction of Puerto Rico, why only a fraction of that money has actually been spent to help the island rebuild. We're trying to find out why today. And Adi Martinez Roman joins us. She's the Director of Operations at the University of Puerto Rico's Resiliency Law Center, focuses on community-led disaster recovery. She's with us from San Juan. Now, I want to note that just 2 days before Hurricane Fiona struck Puerto Rico last month, a House committee held a hearing on the 5-year status of FEMA recovery efforts on the island after Hurricanes Irma and Maria. The consensus, recovery and reconstruction, obviously, in Puerto Rico has been very slow. Chris Curry is the Director for Emergency Management and National Preparedness Issues in the Government Accountability Office, and he told the House committee that the island's inadequate recovery can be described in one simple set of numbers.
So, you know, $21 billion obligated, $407 million spent. Just within utilities, for example, like the grid, $40 million spent. So that kind of gives you a sense of there's been a lot of work done behind the scenes to plan, but not the actual work.
Put another way, in the past 5 years, only 2% of the federal dollars committed to long-term reconstruction projects in Puerto Rico has actually been spent. Curry, who recently prepared a 34-page report on this, says there are a lot of challenges the island faces that sets it apart.
So let's take Hurricane Ian, for example, that just happened in Florida. Remember right after they were talking about millions and millions of people in Florida without power, and how quickly was power restored? Very, very fast. You don't hear about it anymore, do you? So there's a couple of reasons for that. One is the power grid was way better than like a place like Puerto Rico beforehand, much more resilient to disasters. Two, it was way easy to marshal the resources prior to the hurricane, and they have agreements with other states, other power companies, to basically just an absolute invasion of power workers to come in and restore the power quickly. That was not as possible in Puerto Rico. It's an island 1,000 miles away from Florida. So that was more complicated.
Another difference? Between May 2017 and March of 2022, Puerto Rico was in bankruptcy, a debt crisis amounting to nearly 70% of the territory's GDP forced Puerto Rico to seek the largest government bankruptcy in U.S. history. And Curry said that meant the Puerto Rican government had few options to quickly move money in a disaster.
A state like Florida has the resources to immediately pay for the restoration of some of these things. And even if they don't have the money in their budget, they can do things like take out debt, issue bonds, get loans. They have the access to the capital to start the work immediately. And so because of the bankruptcy, Puerto Rico started none of that after the disaster.
Instead, the island has been completely reliant on federal funds for its reconstruction projects.
The problem on the federal side is when Congress appropriates money after a disaster like they did in Maria, they did it pretty quickly. That money doesn't just get transferred from the Treasury to Puerto Rico's checking account to start writing checks. Those are reimbursement programs, which means you do the work, you scope it out, you start the work, you get reimbursed as the work goes on. So, but it's pretty hard to start work if you don't have money to start it. So what's happened over the last 5 years is a lot of planning and discussion and scoping of what all the repairs are going to be, and a lot of challenge and confusion on both sides about how to do that, and very little work.
That was Chris Curry, Director for Emergency Management and National Preparedness Issues in the Government Accountability Office. He's been extensively following recovery efforts in Puerto Rico on FEMA's front since Hurricane Maria struck in 2017. As I mentioned, we're joined today by Adi Martinez-Roman, and I'd also like to bring into the conversation now Deepak Lambda Nieves. He's a research director at the Center for a New Economy, a nonpartisan think tank that's focused on Puerto Rico's economy. Deepak, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me on your show.
And I should know that you're also joining us from San Juan as well, and you're co-author of Puerto Rico Recovery Task Force, a detailed report on the challenges in the recovery process on the island. Now, I'd actually like to explore, there's a big set of challenges here, but I want to get into them through a specific example that many people have familiarity with. And Chris Curry had mentioned that in what we just heard. The power. After every major storm, power is the first thing to go out and the first thing to get restored in most places. So, Deepak, tell me, what's the difference between Puerto Rico and Florida or Texas or Louisiana that's made power still continuously so unreliable there? I mean, are there no agreements that Puerto Rico has with other U.S. states for assistance after a hurricane?
So I would say, Meghna, that yes, Chris Curry mentioned several factors. I mean, one of them is that even in the best of times, reconstructions are highly regulated and bureaucratic processes where numerous agencies and actors intervene. And in our case, even before Maria, we were not in the best of times. I mean, you just mentioned this in your audio. For over a decade, we've had a declining economy and a bankrupt public sector. A bankrupt public sector that included a bankrupt public utility that wasn't providing adequate service to people even before the storms hit. We haven't seen much improvement in that area after privatization, which is another problem, another layer of problems that we've been facing in our electricity sector. Now, another factor that I would highly underscore is that during Trump's presidency, Congress, HUD, and FEMA imposed rules and conditions on Puerto Rico that were discriminatory, I would say onerous, and also unreasonable. and these conditions were not imposed on other jurisdictions that had suffered disasters in 2017, like Florida and Texas. And I would say that a third factor is that austerity programs and policies have seriously eroded the public sector's capacity to provide basic services, let alone deploy billion-dollar projects and programs. And these austerity measures have been implemented for a decade and a half by local governments, but were seriously intensified and accelerated by the Fiscal Control Board, which is an institution imposed by Congress to address our fiscal crisis and our bankruptcy. So there's a series of factors that help explain why it takes so long for the grid to come back online, as well as for the reconstruction in total to actually reach the people that it needs to.
I see. So I think it's a little challenging to really visualize or wrap our minds around all of those factors at the same time. So let's break it down a little bit here. Deepak, first of all, what about the reimbursement aspect of how FEMA distributes funds? You heard Chris Curry talk about that. It's like the money has to be spent first by the government on the ground, put roughly, and then FEMA comes in and gives and reimburses those funds. Is that how it's ideally supposed to work?
Well, that's the structure in general of how reconstructions work, right? So local governments put up the money, and on a reimbursement basis, then they get paid back, right? So governments that are cash-strapped, like the government of Puerto Rico, and also industries in Puerto Rico, which were also cash-strapped, because this system actually cascades down to the local contractors, right? They have to pay their employees first, and then they get reimbursed up the chain. So this creates, you know, being bankrupt and in a stagnant economy for so many years creates a series of problems that move up and down a chain of services in the reconstruction. And so that has been a significant challenge. But, you know, over the last 5 years, have we done enough to actually address these structural challenges? And the answer, I think, is no. And so part of it is on the structure itself of post-disaster recovery and the systems and programs in place from the federal government, but also part of it is on our local government, who needs to step up more quickly and actually discover and design solutions for these problems.
Okay, so Adi, can you just jump in there? Because Deepak was talking about what the local government in Puerto Rico needs to do. What are your thoughts on that? What are the potential solutions that can be executed on the ground by the Puerto Rican government?
Yes, I completely agree with the way Deepak has described the issue. But when you go into the way that the local government decided to plan its or act during this reconstruction process, it has basically centralized everything in one agency, which is the Core 3. Which is the reconstruction agency, and the funds from HUD through the housing department. And so the government of Puerto Rico chose the most centralized way of reconstruction that can be chosen by a local government. And that has not helped at all to make the process more coherent, like the planning process. Chris Curry, which I'm a fan of, He described that a lot of the money has been gone to trying to figure out planning projects. Yes, a lot of time has gone to trying to figure out how to comply with federal requisites project by project. But there's another layer to that. There has not been real efficient planning across regions and really figuring out what are the real solutions that would guarantee that this reconstruction ends up in things being more resilient towards future disasters. We don't want to rebuild as it is because the systems are not working and what we have is not working. And the government of Puerto Rico, instead of really being able to concert and a structured and decentralized way with local knowledge, has been centralizing the solutions through the experts in these two agencies and trying with federal agencies that also do not have local knowledge to push individual projects.
Uh-huh.
So I think it goes beyond just being slow, it's also being inefficient.
To push individual projects, though, meaning what? What are you hinting at there, Adi?
For example, the hazard mitigation funds are FEMA funds that are able for us to spend in mitigating infrastructure for future disasters. So those funds can be used to better our waterways, to better our bridges. We have not seen a concerted plan to try to solve the fact if it rains 3 feet in the mountains, what are the coast towns, how are the coast towns are going to be mitigated and adapted to receive all that water. What we see is makeshift planning, where you see a municipality says, this is my priority, or an agency says, this is my other priority. And there is no coherent planning. Uh-huh. That's what we mean.
I see.
And in the electric grid, for example, which is a main issue in Puerto Rico, in the electric grid, there is already local knowledge and local studies that have been done with companies in the United States about how we can make a different system of generation and distribution that would not be as vulnerable as a gas-based system as they're trying to rebuild. But like Deepak said, they have resorted to privatization in order to be able to rebuild the same type of system, which is a centralized fossil fuel-based cable distribution system that fails us every time a storm comes.
I see. Okay. Well, first of all, about Core 3 that you mentioned, Adi, that's the Office for Recovery, Reconstruction, and Resiliency, which is charged with running Puerto Rico's recovery effort and has been since or post-Hurricane Maria. Now, we have a clip here from Manuel Laboy, who's the executive director of Core 3. And he said that one of the major reasons why recovery has been so slow is because of those federal regulations that restrict cash from being released until after projects are completed. That reimbursement basis that we've been talking about. And here's what he had to say about that at a congressional hearing last month.
That's the reason why we came up with this creative program called Working Capital Advance. It has been instituted 2 months ago. It was first in place for municipalities, then expanded to the Power Authority, and then to the Water Authority, and soon being expanded to the Puerto Rico Department of Education and then Public Housing. That's the reason why you have seen a major increase in disbursements. Because of the last 2 months, we've been advancing 25% of the obligated money by FEMA.
So Deepak, do you think that more of the money is actually getting out faster now, as Manuel Laboy was saying there?
Well, I certainly hope it does. But I think that we need to think bigger rather than just a small fix that Manuel Laboy is talking about. I think that destruction caused by Fiona actually presents us with an opportunity to rethink many of the plans and programs of the ongoing reconstruction, which, as we've just mentioned, has just proceeded at a painfully slow pace. And for several years, we at the Center for a New Economy have advocated for the creation of a Puerto Rico-led recovery task force that involves, aside from government actors and the Core 3 and the Department of Housing, also incorporates experts, citizens, and grassroots involvement. Now, this task force could ensure that we finally develop a bottom-up unified planning effort, which is something that Adi was referring to, that actually helps us define programs and projects that serve those most in need, and actually allows us to leverage billions of dollars in federal funding to recover our communities and restore our economy. So what's the point of putting together and these small fixes, another action plan, when we already have one for Irma, we have one for Maria, we have one for the earthquakes? Perhaps what's most useful is for us to sit down and rethink the policies, the programs, and the entire governance structure of the reconstruction. What has become patently clear for us is that these types of events and the disasters they trigger, they're going to become more frequent. So we need to rethink the reconstruction, maybe with a focus on climate change, climate mitigation, and climate adaptation. To achieve something like this, we can't rely solely on the employees from the housing department, the Core 3, and their private consultants. We need to put together a governance structure that provides coherence in order to define the correct public policies and execute them effectively. I've been speaking a lot with Robert Olshansky, one of the global experts on post-disaster reconstruction issues. And during his visits to the island, he warned us that reconstructions are complex and fluid processes that require constant decision-making. There's going to be some improvisation, but we need a lot of monitoring, evaluation, and constant review of priorities and strategies. So these types of processes require a credible and transparent governance structure that incorporates various groups into decision-making in the public and does decisions in the public eye, not in closed rooms or in the offices of private consultants. And that's perhaps what we need moving forward.
The credibility and transparency, as you said, in this whole process. So Deepak Lamba Nieves and Adi Martinez-Roman, stand by for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk about what your ideas are for how we actually fix this complex, broken system in Puerto Rico regarding its reconstruction. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're trying to get to the bottom of why, 5 years after Hurricane Maria, the island of Puerto Rico is still suffering from a lack of reconstruction efforts, dollars, and projects underway to make Puerto Rico resilient against climate change, against hurricanes and earthquakes and all of the challenges of the 21st century. I'm joined today by Adi Martinez-Roman. She's Director of Operations at the University of Puerto Rico's Resiliency Law Center, with us from San Juan. And Deepak Lamba Nieves joins us as well, also from San Juan. He's Research Director at the Center for a New Economy, a nonpartisan think tank that's focused on Puerto Rico's economy. Now, Deepak and Adi, on this show, we actually really like to try and tease apart how bureaucracies work, right? Because they have an impact on all our lives. But in so doing, oftentimes things get confusing because bureaucracies are confusing. So at the risk of oversimplifying here, I'm just trying to describe or discover what the underlying forces are that have led Puerto Rico to this place now. So, Deepak, is it a combination of just sort of existing complexities in how federal dollars are spent, FEMA dollars in particular, complexities and confusions there, along with lack of transparency and, you know, to put it mildly, years-long mismanagement by the Puerto Rican government that's led it to that state of bankruptcy, as we talked about, and also just existing political tensions between Washington and Puerto Rico, even though Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. I mean, broadly speaking, are those the major driving factors here?
They are. They're the primary driving factors, but I would add one that's very important, which is austerity. Austerity programs that have been put in place for over a decade in Puerto Rico, you know, government, local government policies, but also imposed by Congress through the control board to actually cut back on important government budgets. Let's take an example of mayors. Local mayors in Puerto Rico are seeing governmental transfers from the central government cut by at least half or more in the next coming years. What does that mean for many municipalities in the island? Municipalities that, by the way, are the first responders, are the, you know, are the basic unit of government that actually serves the people directly immediately after a hurricane and actually save lives. These municipal governments are seeing their budgets slashed almost completely. How can we expect the local mayor to fill out the FEMA forms, you know, go through the process, understand the endless bureaucracy that they face as a public official, and deploy their employees and the contractors to build projects when they're working on a shoestring budget. So these are some of the complications that at the local level we start seeing. And this is the cause of austerity programs. This is not caused necessarily by lack of imagination, by lack of knowledge at the local level. In fact, local knowledge has saved us. It has allowed us to move forward despite all these structural obstacles that they face.
Yeah. Point taken about how a theoretical concept like austerity becomes real, right, on the ground in the local municipalities that you're talking about. But just to be clear, those austerity measures were put into place in response to Puerto Rico's debt crisis, right?
In part, yes. Okay. Economic and debt crisis. Puerto Rico's economy hasn't grown in over a decade. So we're facing a huge series of hurdles even before any storm started hitting us.
Okay. So when we're dealing with, as Adi described so vividly earlier, essentially mass suffering by many, many people that's caused by so many complicated factors, it can feel a little bit overwhelming. So help me break it down here. Deepak first, and then Adi, I'll turn to you. Where would you begin? Where's the first place you'd turn to? And I know that's not only one, because these are all related, but what's the first fix you would make to improve this? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I would say that structurally, like I mentioned in the previous segment, we need to rethink the whole governance structure of the reconstruction in a way to make it more transparent, make it more inclusive with regards to the voices of the community and citizen experts. That's at the structural level. But also at the local level, in the level of designs and program designs, you know, currently, at least when we look at the housing sector, the housing programs that have been designed to attend to the damage caused by the storm are patchwork programs. They don't tackle whole communities. They don't look at the problem from the ground up. They basically adopt a retail approach where if somebody applies and gets funding to rebuild their home, well, that's great. But if your neighbor doesn't, then that community is, you know, a little bit left behind because only 1 out of 10 residents in that community are receiving the needed care. So we need to place attention and to redesign many of the programs in a way that tackles whole communities, that addresses community problems in conjunction with community leaders and community voices. That hasn't happened, and I think that needs to happen fast.
And these are programs that are specifically for Puerto Rico, or are they, you know, broader FEMA programs that apply wherever a disaster strikes?
So these are reconstruction and recovery programs which are designed locally. We have a say in how we design these programs. Granted, a lot of the rules and regulations that we have to follow are defined by these federal agencies, and some of them are really complicated straitjackets that are difficult to navigate.
Okay. So, Adi, what were your thoughts about that? Like, where would you start in terms of, like, fixing this complex problem?
Yes, I just wanted to emphasize that all that you have spoken in the last segment is within a context of a huge disaster recovery economy that comes to Puerto Rico in a moment of austerity. We cannot forget we're talking more than $80 billion after 2017 disasters, earthquake, pandemic, and Fiona. We're talking about more than $80 billion that converged into an economy where, of course, you're going to have big interests involved in trying to get the contracts, in trying to participate in this reconstruction. And as Deepak has mentioned, the major failing has been, how do you do locally based planning that inserts the knowledge of the people that are actually in the ground doing the work. It has been a centralized top-down model. And since I was working in Oxfam America, we have been pushing for community-led recovery. Since 2019, we've worked with different actors to propose a model. It was presented as a project by Chuy Garcia. It was called the Community-Driven Recovery for Puerto Rico Act, and it proposed an option to the centralized solution that was offered by other by the federal government, which was a monitor. They assigned a single man, a federal monitor, assigned by President Trump to come and help move along the reconstruction. That just does not work. We need, as Deepak has mentioned, a group, a task force of local experts, local community leaders, members from different sectors that actually have a governance role in the reconstruction. And some people will say, oh, but that's another layer of bureaucracy. And I am very emphatic in saying no. We are actually proposing to change a governance that has basically centralized everything in the hands of a few and is not being efficient enough to attend the needs, the real needs of the communities in Puerto Rico to adapt and to mitigate for future disasters. So for us to stay as we are means we lose our lives, and of course, we are also losing our community in the paradise that we live in. We all, the Puerto Ricans, we want to stay in Puerto Rico. We want to make it viable for us to live here. And the only way to do that is to recognize the local knowledge, the local capacity of groups in Puerto Rico that are already bringing forth effective solutions for their communities.
Mm-hmm. So, Deepak, do you have an example in mind of this kind of locally driven but with federal partnership reconstruction planning and execution that we've already done that works?
Yes, definitely. So there's one clear example, which is the Sandy, Hurricane Sandy Task Force that was created immediately after Superstorm Sandy hit the metro area of New York. That's the prime example that we're using at the Center for a New Economy to actually design or propose this new design for a task force. A proposal that, by the way, has received support from people in Congress, important people in Congress like Chuck Schumer, Nidia Velázquez, and several other members of Congress. So there's a letter that went out to President Biden to actually support this idea that we need to think about this differently. The second example that I would give you is a somewhat obscure one, but very important one. In 1985, there was a huge landslide that hit the community of Mameyes in Ponce. And that was, I think, the worst landslide disaster on you know, in the United States and its territories ever. And what happened as a result of that landslide was that a community-based approach designed primarily by a wonderful planner called Lucila Marvel, who's still a mentor to us all in planning, she came up with a structure that actually allowed FEMA and local agencies to work with communities to design a disaster reconstruction process that eventually led to the relocation of a whole community to a new area decided upon and supported by community members at every step of the way, that in nine months, reconstructed or built new housing for hundreds of families in Puerto Rico. So it only took them 9 months in 1985 to navigate all that. Why? As Adi's mentioning, because the community was involved from day one. When you have community involvement, things move faster because people are informed and engaged in moving things forward.
Yeah. So about the Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force as a template for what could happen in Puerto Rico, I just want to remind folks that on December 7th of 2012, President Obama signed an executive order that created the task force, right? And in that executive order, it said the task force's purpose was to, quote, ensure that the federal government continues to provide appropriate resources to support affected state, local, and tribal communities to improve the region's resilience, health, and prosperity for building for the future. And in fact, I'm also looking here at the time, Sean Donovan, who was HUD secretary under the Obama administration, said that local governments and community leaders are the front lines in disaster recovery, and it is the job of the federal government to have their backs by supporting their efforts. So this template exists, Deepak, as you've pointed out. I just want to hear from both of you what you think is stopping us or preventing a similar model from being established right now in Puerto Rico.
Yes, I think we have.
Go ahead, Adi.
Sorry. No, we've been definitely pushing a decentralized model for the reconstruction. adoption since, like I told you, the second year when we were actually being able to look at what was happening after Hurricane Maria. And we had seen the experience not only of Sandy, but also of Louisiana, which after Hurricane Katrina, they learned that the centralization of reconstruction process does not work. So in the next disaster they suffered, they decentralized. I think, and this is my opinion about why it's just not being done, is because the huge size of this disaster reconstruction economy makes it a very important interest for a more privatized approach to reconstruction. The mentality that who is going to get the contracts to be able to implement this reconstruction has been the focus. How to try to solve what exists within the privatized mindset has been a major barrier in order for agencies such as FEMA and our local government to actually break free and think about a total different governance to reconstruction.
Mm. So a lot of people stand to make a lot of money from the current system as it is, Adi, is what you're saying.
That's very elegantly put.
And so, Deepak, same question to you. What do you think is standing in the way of adopting at least a form of an extant model that has worked?
Well, I think several factors. I think one is history. Puerto Rico has a historical tradition of doing top-down centralized planning since the 1940s. So that work doesn't work in our favor. The second, I think, is governmental inertia. As Adi's mentioned, this system serves somebody. This is the reason why it's put in place. And we've done the studies at the Center for New Economy. At the beginning, at the early stages of disaster recovery, we saw that 90% of federal contracts were going to U.S. mainland firms and only 10% to Puerto Rico-based firms. So there's a lot of companies in the mainland U.S. that stand to gain a lot from this reconstruction and who don't necessarily like to see things shaken up. I would say the third factor is political inertia. Members of Congress have urged President Biden to take a look at this proposal and act on it. I don't know what's happening at the executive level. I do know that there's interest in helping the Puerto Rican economy move forward. There's a new task force in the Department of Commerce that's looking at that. There's another new task force on energy issues that has recently been named by the Secretary of Energy and President Biden. Why don't we fold all those efforts into one coherent task force that allows us to actually comprehensively, and again, with better and more participation from community leaders, to actually plan out this reconstruction in a holistic and systemic way. I think, you know, it's an issue of political will. I hope the executive branch and President Biden and his staff takes a serious look at this proposal, because I think that if we expect to do the same things and get different results, it's going to be a recipe for disaster.
Well, Deepak Lamba-Nieves is research director at the Center for a New Economy and co-author of the report called Puerto Rico's Recovery Task Force, a detailed report on the challenges to Puerto Rico's recovery process and how to fix them. We have a link to that, by the way, at onpointradio.org. Deepak, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Adi Martinez-Roman, Director of Operations at the University of Puerto Rico's Resiliency Law Center. Adi, it's been a great pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for the space.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.